Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the gathering storm surrounding the slumlord billionaire owner of the NBA franchise, the Los Angeles Clippers, whose poisonous private racism has been exposed in a telephone conversation with his expensive mistress, overnight devaluing the millions Donald Sterling has spent over the years in self-promotion through paid advertising in the Los Angeles Times for staged banquets headlined by D-list celebrities, where he awarded himself honors such as Humanitarian of the Year. Ben Carrington, a professor of sociology at the University of Texas at Austin and author of Race, Sport, and Politics, joins us to discuss the plantation mentality of billionaire owners of sports teams, some of whom look upon their players as personal chattel. Then we'll examine the Enhanced Defense Cooperation Agreement between the U.S. and the Philippines, signed on the last stop of President Obama's trip to Asia, where he visited four countries involved in disputes with China. Joshua Kurlansik, a former columnist for Time, correspondent for The American Prospect, writer for Mother Jones, and author of Charm Offensive, How China's Soft Power is Transforming the World, joins us to discuss China's displeasure at Obama's so-called pivot to Asia that they increasingly see as an attempt to contain China. Then finally, we will speak with Christopher Mitchell, the director of the Telecommunications as Commons Initiative at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, about the more than 400 towns and cities across America who have installed or are planning to install fiber broadband municipal networks as an alternative to the telecom and cable monopolies who appear to have captured Obama's FCC, which is poised to end the government's commitment to net neutrality. We will discuss the need to both support municipalities who are building networks to circumvent cable monopolies with high-speed broadband that other advanced nations enjoy, at the same time holding the FCC's feet to the fire so they don't sell out the public and abandon net neutrality. And joining us now is Ben Carrington, a professor of sociology at the University of Texas at Austin. He previously taught at the University of Brighton in England and currently serves on the editorial boards of Identities, Global Studies in Culture and Power, the Journal of Sports and Social Issues, and the International Review for the Sociology of Sport. His latest book is Race, Sport, and Politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ben Carrington.
Hi.
And I'm not sure whether in Austin, Texas, the Donald Sterling story has quite the intensity that it has here in Los Angeles. And I must say there's a certain element of schadenfreude in it, in as much as over the years I've wondered about this man who keeps buying full-page ads in the L.A. Times almost every other day, awarding himself Humanitarian of the Year, Humanitarian of the Week, Humanitarian of the Month. There's a sort of rogues gallery of D-list celebrities that he has on these big full-page ads, and representatives of the NAACP and the Holocaust Museum and other sort of civic figures, if you will, all clearly buying a reputation. It's certainly based upon this leaked audio tape. no wonder he was trying to buy a reputation. The real story is so incredibly damning. So how do you explain this disconnect between this public figure, this owner, who has a team that's largely made up of African-American athletes, who can be so racist in his attitude towards his own players?
I think it tells us something about the different world that a lot of the owners live in, and the fact that in their minds they really do. They don't just own the club, they don't just own the franchise, they don't just own the teams, but to a large extent they really do believe that they own the players. And so I think we've just had a really interesting insight into the hyper privileged world that a lot of these owners, occupy. I mean, in coming from Texas, we have our own versions of what you've been finding out about Donald Sterling in Los Angeles. So Jerry Jones, the owner of the Dallas Cowboys, and even Mark Cuban, the owner of the Mavericks. I mean, these are characters who, to all intents and purposes, basically set up rules for themselves. And then they're not used to any type of pushback, any type of limitations on what they can get away with. So although the Donald Sterling empire seems to be collapsing by the minute, he's actually a lot more typical of the other owners than they would actually like to admit. Now, it does seem that some of his language is more extreme, but it's interesting that so few of the other owners have come out and spoken against him up until now, perhaps with the exception of Michael Jordan. One of the questions for me is, to what extent is Donald Sterling completely exceptional as an owner, or is he just actually... Has he gone slightly too far compared to what many of the other owners think and feel?
Well, it does feel like, just if reading the transcript of what's been made available of this apparently one-hour phone conversation with his mistress, a woman who his wife alleges is a money-grubbing seductress. Apparently she has a background as something of an expensive courtesan. He certainly showered. I think he bought 2 Bentleys, a Ferrari, and a Range Rover, as well as an expensive condominium. And it looks as though perhaps she may have even set him up, because some of these questions were quite leading. But her question to him was, do you know that you have a whole team that's black that plays for you? This is after he'd made all these racist statements. And just to get to what we were just talking about, this is what Sterling says. Do you know I support them? I give them food and clothes and cars and houses. Who gives it to them? Does someone else give it to them? Who makes the game? Do I make the game, or do they make the game? So there you have a kind of plantation mentality.
Absolutely. So it's not their hard work that has brought the wealth to the Clippers. It's not their... And I mean, let's remember, I mean, I think he initially invested something like about 12.5 million.
Yeah, 13.5, yeah.
Yeah, and it's now worth 50 times that. I mean, so he personally has benefited hugely from his association with the Clippers. But there's still this notion that he's the one that produces the wealth, he's the one that makes the wealth, and these players are just, they're just these kind of like workhorses that have no creativity, that, and in a sense that they should be lucky to be playing for his team. So you're exactly right. There is a plantation style mentality about how he views these black bodies, and there's almost like a certain almost disdain for their work, and even that he has to, the fact he refers to himself as given them food, given them clothes, given them cars, given them houses, as you say, it's the level of kind of the patronizing tone is just at one level it's remarkable, but another level actually I don't think it is, and it would be. If we were able to record some of the private conversations of many owners, I wouldn't be surprised if they were actually that different from what Sterling's been articulating.
So is this an international phenomenon then, not just in American sports, whether it be football or basketball? I mean, there's been some, I believe, isn't there an American that bought, was it Manchester United, one of the big soccer franchises in England? It's extremely unpopular. I'm not sure how the Russian oligarch, how popular he is with Chelsea. He certainly acted as though he'd won the cup and not them,
Yeah, but it's one of the noticeable differences when you look at the position of owners in European sports, and particularly if we take soccer as an example. So one of the things that's notable for me as a British transplant to the US is that at the end of most of the major sports championships, the cup is awarded to the owner. I mean, that's really striking. That would never happen in soccer. So hopefully in 2 or 3 weeks' time, if Liverpool manage to win the English Champions League, it will be Steven Gerrard, the Liverpool captain, who will hold up the championship trophy. So there's and the owners, so it's true, so the Glazers own Manchester United, and similarly Liverpool Football Club is now actually owned by Fenway Sports Group, who also own the Boston Red Sox. But the owners of English soccer teams have to be very careful about the extent to which they claim actual ownership, because in many of those, for many soccer fans in England and in Europe, there's a notion that the fans are actually the owners of the clubs, that there's a much stronger involvement of the fans, and the players sometimes have a much kind of greater say. So to such a degree that when Liverpool Football Club was taken over a couple of years ago by Tom Hicks and Gillette, that the owners were so disliked that it wasn't safe for them to actually go to the ground. Like, the Liverpool fans turned on them to such a degree. And even at Manchester United, the Glazers aren't actually that popular there. So there is much more fan control and fan democracy and fan the fans have a greater say over how these clubs are run. To some degree, that's kind of naive, and certainly the case that many English fans think they have a degree of ownership over the clubs in which they don't. Although in certain cases, such as Barcelona, they are actually cooperatives, so the fans actually are the collective owners of the club. So the, sure. There's a very different relationship between... And the very fact that in England and in much of Europe you would refer to these teams as clubs as opposed to franchises indicates the extent to which American sports leagues are much more commercially driven, with rich owners who, if they want to, can actually take the franchise from one city to another. It's inconceivable that Manchester United would leave Manchester and go to a different part of England. So there is a different relationship between the fans and the owners that you see in European sports as compared to the US.
Yeah, indeed, the exception to the rule here in the United States in terms of football, of course, is the Green Bay Packers, which is owned by the community. And the main reason why I always supported them, because I can't stand the Dallas owner and that whole ostentatious Texas thing about America's team, you know. It reeks of commercialism,
that,
you know.
Absolutely, and a team that makes money, a team that makes Jerry Jones even richer every year, and that's not successful. I mean, that's one of the really interesting things about the ways in which there's a false notion of competition within American sports, is that the rigging of the system to ensure that the teams that finish down the bottom of the table get a chance to recruit the players through the draft system, you know, the best players through the draft system the following year. And the fact that Sterling, I mean, many people suggested that one of the reasons why Sterling was tolerated for so many years was by some of the other owners, aside from his repulsive views and the ways in which as a slum landlord for many years he'd been exploiting working class people, was the fact that most of the other owners are quite happy to play a team that they know they can beat year after year. I mean, as long as Los Angeles for many years had a strong team in terms of the LA Lakers, it didn't really matter that the Clippers were so poor on the court. So actually, Sir Sterling was fine. He made money. The rest of the owners didn't really mind because there was an easy win every year. So you really do see the false hypocrisy of thinking about American sports as being this kind of pinnacle of American capitalism when the system is really rigged.
Again, I'm speaking with Ben Carrington, who's a professor of sociology at the University of Texas at Austin. He previously taught at the University of Brighton in England and currently serves on the editorial boards of Identities, Global Studies in Culture and Power, the Journal of Sports and Social Issues, and the International Review for Sociology of Sports. His latest book is Race, Sport, and Politics. So in terms of your latest book, Ben Carrington, you couldn't have more of a confluence of race and sport. And, of course, the politics are happening now with the NBA commissioner, and it's now a huge press story in terms of Sterling. He hasn't said anything yet, and, you know, obviously there's some sort of ridiculous double talk about the idea that, you know, we've got to wait until this tapes or authenticated, when it's pretty clear that it is what it is. But there's nothing more flagrant than his racist statements and the idea that he could actually bring by his, you know, girlfriends and hookers and others. I mean, he actually sued a former hooker who he called a $500 a night trick. He actually, that all got on the public record because he sued her, because he was sick. He wanted back the house and the expensive cars he'd given her and the huge amount of money he's given her. And presumably that's going to happen with the latest one. But he used to traipse these women through the locker rooms after the games where all the players are showering, and would say to these women, look at those beautiful black bodies. I mean, again, it's just so odious and so plantation-like. It's sickening.
Yeah, but that's one of the interesting things about this is, I mean, what you've just mentioned and what you've just described, this isn't somebody like hiding away and doing these things in private. I mean, actually, if you go back to the transcript, one of the interesting things about it actually was, it wasn't so much that he was upset with his girlfriend or whoever she was kind of hanging out with Magic Johnson. It was the fact that she was doing this in public, you know. So in his mind, that, you know, she couldn't do these things in public; they had to be kept in private. Any kind of relationship she had with black athletes, when everything he was doing was in public. I mean, I think this is also a story about Los Angeles and Los Angeles politics. The fact that the NAACP of Los Angeles were willing and had honoured him over many years is an example of the fact that he was clearly savvy enough politically to know that if he donated money to the local chapter, that would give him a degree of cover. So actually, I think that as much as this is a story about the NBA and Sterling, it's also a story, I think, about the ways in which racial politics operates in a city like Los Angeles, where wealth can buy you access and allow for you to engage in practices that otherwise wouldn't be tolerated. You know, and so in many ways, he's been caught out by his own kind of, you know, arrogance. But also, we need to think about who else made it possible. Who were the kind of the players, if you like, in the kind of Los Angeles system that kind of tolerated him for so long as he was writing checks?
Well, it's sort of the old joke, you know, if you strip off the tinsel of Hollywood and Los Angeles, underneath there's real tinsel. You know, this is a guy, as I say, every other day in the LA Times, there's full-page ads of him, pictures of him smiling there with all of these D-list celebrities that he's managed to get out for a rubber chicken dinner and thrown a few dollars their way. And invariably, again, you know, representatives of the NAACP and the Holocaust Museum and others would join in this pantheon of, you know, minor celebrities. So I just don't understand how somebody could have spent so much money on trying to make themselves into creating this kind of image of respectability and at the same time be such a poisonous, loathsome human being. I mean, I guess it could only happen here in Hollywood.
Yeah, but it's a good example of hubris, isn't it? I mean, this is what a certain degree of wealth gives you. It gives you a sense of entitlement. It produces a sense of privilege, in which you begin to lose sight of the normal constraints that the rest of us have to live by. And I think also, I mean, he's unfortunate in this sense. I mean, he's probably sitting there thinking one of the interesting things is the extent to which sponsors are now pulling support away from the Clippers. I mean, if it's one thing for there to be kind of media outrage, it's one thing for people on Twitter and social media to begin to be criticizing him. But as soon as the major sponsors begin to pull away from the Clippers, which looks like they're doing right now, that's significant. And so he's probably sitting there thinking, like, what did I do? Like, what suddenly changed? Well, I mean, he was unfortunate enough to be in the same news cycle as Clive and Bundy. So in terms of the kind of context of this week's news cycle, there was no questions of race were in the news a lot this week. And one of the other interesting aspects of this, I think, is quite interesting, is the extent to which many of the players themselves have actually been very vocal. You know, once you have a league which is 70-75%, maybe 80% African-American, and you have a number of those players who do have a media platform, they're not going to be taking such sentiments lightly. They're going to speak out, and they have been speaking out much more forcibly, actually, than the owners and the NBA itself, which, as you said, is trying to still toe this line, like trying to toe the line that we need to authenticate the tape first, we can't rush to judgment, et cetera, et cetera. Well, you know, in this kind of news cycle age, that doesn't cut it. So there's a kind of a pincer movement whereby, you know, as some people said, you know, it's been a bad week to be a white male racist, and it's, you know, and that's not always the case. Like, normally,
well, it should be a bad week every week.
It should be, but it's not. Right. So it's just,
in closing there, Ben, don't you think that at the end of the day, this guy, whose his real name is Donald Tokowitz, who grew up in the poor side of town here and has now, you know, lives in the marbled mansions in Beverly Hills and has paid all this money to burnish his reputation as the humanitarian of the year, the century of the galaxy. He is still going to make a ton of money when he's forced to sell this franchise, if it comes to that.
True, yeah, just as the slave owners often argue that they need to be compensated for when they had to give up slavery. So it'll be interesting to see. His reputation is shot, and it will be fascinating. I mean, it's a great American story. It's a great Los Angeles story. I mean, I'm sure I can see the script writers and screenplay writers of Los Angeles run into their computers right now to kind of hack out a mini biopic.
If only we had Nathaniel West alive today. Well, I think...
Hopefully it will put to rest this myth that has been circulated since 2008, predominantly by the Wall Street Journal and others, that we now live in a post-racial society. I mean, this is in the same week that the Supreme Court kind of struck down the Michigan case around affirmative action, so, I mean, we need to read these things concurrently. The stuff around Clive and Bundy, the kind of attacks on Obama, the attacks by the Supreme Court against affirmative action. And in the midst of this, we actually see revealed actually some of the kind of the stark reality of the existence of forms of anti-black racism within American society today.
Well, Ben Carrington, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Ben Carrington. He's a professor of sociology at the University of Texas at Austin. He previously taught at the University of Brighton in England and currently serves on the editorial boards of Identities, Global Studies in Culture and Power, the Journal of Sports and Social Issues, and the International Review for the Sociology of Sport. His latest book is Race, Sport, and Politics. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the Enhanced Defense Cooperation Agreement the U.S. has just signed with the Philippines.
It's the
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Joshua Kurtlancic, who is a fellow for Southeast Asia at the Council on Foreign Relations, who has been a columnist for Time magazine, a special correspondent for The New Republic, a senior correspondent for The American Prospect, and a contributing writer for Mother Jones. His books include Charm Offensive, How China's Soft Power is Threatening the World, and Democracy in Retreat, The Revolt of the Middle Class and the Worldwide Decline of Representative Government. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joshua Kurtlancic.
Thanks for having me.
And the president has just signed the Enhanced Defense Cooperation Agreement with the Philippines. It's taken 10 years to generate this pact, although the U.S., of course, had up until 1992 had one of its biggest bases in the world in the Philippines. There is, of course, some local resentment, but most of the reaction to it is coming against it, is coming from China. Quite vociferous. The Chinese leadership via their official news outlet are describing the Philippines as the troublemaker of the South China Sea and warning the U.S. that given that the Philippines is in a bitter territorial row with China, the move is particularly disturbing as it may embolden Manila in dealing with Beijing. So what's happening to this so-called pivot to Asia? Is it less of a pivot to Asia than a containment of China? At least that's how the Chinese see it.
Well, first of all, it's hardly surprising that the agreement provoked a reaction in China. I think the Philippines and the U.S. accepted that. What's important to look at is not what the Chinese say immediately after, but their actual reaction. In terms of their military actions and how they act in the South China Sea. I think the pivot is about a lot more than the Philippines. It involves basically all of the Pacific Rim. And although the president is never going to say this, there, some aspect of it is, I wouldn't say containment, but is obviously a response to or a proactive measure to support allies in the region against China, potentially. Although he's, of course, never going to say that. But in the specific case of the Philippines, there is an element of that in which it's part of the U.S.'s pivot, but there's also a substantial element in which the Philippines has been looking for this because of their own specific concerns about South China Sea.
Well, the Chinese claim 90% of the South China Sea, and I take it that there has already been something of a standoff between the Philippines and China over what's called the Scarborough Shoals, where a vessel was grounded and it's been occupied by Philippine Navy personnel, and China in turn have blockaded those aboard that grounded ship.
Right. So just to be clear, it's not a grounded ship like there was a ship battle. They actually grounded the ship essentially to create a reef. But right, there's a standoff there. The Chinese have also had multiple standoffs and potentially dangerous incidents with Vietnam in the last few years over the South China Sea. And there's also increasing concern in Malaysia and Indonesia over Chinese action in the South China Sea, although Malaysia and Indonesia tend to be much more restrained in their own response and have better relations with China. So it's a difficult situation. I mean, I think what happened in the Philippines was they had a basically incredibly outdated and non-existent Navy and Marines. They've become more worried about their interactions in the South China Sea with China, and they are realizing that they desperately need some reassurance, support, and assistance from the U.S., and they have been pushing the U.S. to provide all of that basically since Obama took office.
So you've described this then more as a Philippine initiative than an American need for a base in Southeast Asia, having had its biggest base in the Pacific already in the Philippines.
Right. Well, there was two bases actually in the Philippines, and they were pushed out because of a whole variety of things, including reasonable Philippine desires to not have forces subject to extraterritorial agreements on their own territory. It's actually kind of interesting now. There have been protests, but because of the great concern over the South China Sea, you actually have a lot of left-wing legislators in the Philippines who 20 years ago would have been among the people who would have definitely wanted the U.S. out, who have been pretty vociferous about the South China Sea. So it doesn't necessarily fall into the usual left-right in the Philippines. So I'm not saying that the pivot is a Philippine-generated initiative or that the administration isn't happy that there's a desire in a number of countries in Southeast Asia for basing rights, just that I don't think that the extent of the assistance and to the Philippines is really what was initially envisioned in the pivot. And actually, the Philippines has wanted the administration to do more, specifically to commit by saying at a summit or at another event, this is exactly what we would do, we the U.S., if China did this in the South China Sea. And so far, the U.S. has refused to do that and has just been kind of supportive but vague. Hillary Clinton said that South China Sea was a national interest. Several U.S. military commanders have said that if there was a greater confrontation, the U.S. would do something to help the Philippines. But actually, the Philippines would like more from the U.S.
Well, I suppose in terms of branding and labeling, both the pivot to Asia, which I understand the White House is trying to change that name. Certainly the reset with Russia has gone nowhere. So in terms of these two brandings, it would seem that the White House is sort of in retreat about them. But what is there? Do they have a new policy or they just have a new name?
Well, I think that obviously the reset with Russia was both a branding failure and just a failure, right? You could have a bad brand, but your product could still be good, or you could have a vice versa. The pivot, which they now call a variety of things, including mostly the rebalance to Asia, I think it's been decently successful. It's supposed to be a military, diplomatic, and economic shift of U.S. priorities to the Pacific Rim. So the military part has been mostly successful in that the U.S. has gotten a lot more cooperation from the Philippines, Australia, Singapore, and a lot of other countries in the region. And it hasn't provoked the kind of anti-Americanism you refer to in the Philippines or other places from 20 years ago. The problem has been mostly that the Obama administration said that it was going to be everything, not just a military shift. And the other parts really haven't taken shape. And since it's been mostly a military shift, it's more likely to antagonize China because that has been the focus of basically all of the efforts. If it was a more comprehensive thing and the other parts had succeeded, it actually possibly would antagonize China less.
So in terms of being drawn into a conflict, What you were saying earlier, Joshua Kurlansik, is that the Philippines want more of an assurance that the U.S. will defend them if China pushes too hard. The U.S. already has that agreement with Japan, and Japan and China are in a bitter row over what's often referred to as a pile of rocks. And their warships are starting to sort of, you know, play chicken with each other. And Japan has already garrisoning a nearby island to the one that's in dispute, the so-called Diu Islands. So that surely is something to be concerned about, isn't it? I mean, two superpowers on a collision course over some, you know, pile of rocks or a pile of coral, that's no way to run the world, is it?
Well, I think that the level of concern, not that the U.S. isn't concerned about the Philippines, but the level of concern about China, Japan, and the U.S. being drawn in is much, much higher. And that's for a lot of reasons, including that Japan itself, even though in theory does not have a military force, the self-defense, the quote-unquote self-defense forces of Japan are significant military. So, that's a major concern. That's probably, I would say, right up there with Ukraine and Pakistan and North Korea as the biggest concerns in the world. The Philippines wants, the U.S. has a treaty with the Philippines where the Philippines wants, like you said, basically the U.S. offer the specific, discrete assurances of exactly what the U.S. would do if China didn't invade the Philippines, in which case the U.S. would be forced by a treaty to respond, but if China did X, Y, Z in the South China Sea. And because our relationship with the Philippines is not the same relationship as with Japan, and because we don't have the confidence in the Philippines military that we have in Japan, the Obama administration is not going to offer them those specific assurances the way they have done it with Japan.
But haven't there been some fairly inflammatory statements from the, I don't know whether it's the Philippine president, Aquino, or other high officials referring to China, making analogies with Imperial Japan in the late 30s and Nazi Germany?
I don't know about Imperial Japan, but yeah, definitely President Aquino, the president of the Philippines, has used the idea that China is like Nazi Germany in 1938. He used that in an interview with New York Times. And I'm not sure if there was other reporters who also were at that interview at the presidential palace. So it's a cycle, you know. I mean, and like in the U.S. or any other country, what happens is, you know, you can get caught in that cycle. And so he doesn't want to look weak. And so then China doesn't want to look weak. So, yeah, he has. You know, I think that the problem, but on the other hand, the Philippines has shown a willingness to take the case to international arbitration. They just submitted their case to international arbitration of, you know, who gets what. How do you respond? How do you divvy up different claims? And they said we're willing to abide by the international arbitrator's ruling. And China said we're not listening. We're not going to the arbitration. Forget that. So. Yeah, I mean, I think President Aquino has said some things, but I think he's also probably more moderate-headed.
So, just in closing, Joshua Kurlansik, what can the White House do to assuage China? Because the Chinese are pretty adamant that this pivot, or whatever they want to rebrand it as, is aimed at containing them. The Secretary of Defense got an earful from his Chinese counterpart when he was over there along those lines. So assuming that the U.S. considers that they have a problem with China, what can they do you think? Or should they do?
Those are two different questions. I mean, I don't think that the problem is responding, like I said, responding to what China says in the media, in their media. The president and everyone else knows that the standard you have to use is to judge by actions. So I think that what they are going to probably continue to try to do is to boost the level of interaction so that even if Secretary of Defense gets an earful, they have direct contact with top leaders in the PLA and other top leaders so that if there is a real problem, they can call them up. In the past, there's been a problem, which when there was major U.S.-China incidents, like you may remember the spy plane incident in 2001, and Colin Powell and President Bush couldn't reach anyone to talk to them. And that's a big problem. Whether they're actually going to, you know, be able to calm down China's concerns, I don't know if that's even possible. I'm not even sure that the administration really wants to do that. I think the policy is based on a shift of assets, and that policy is probably going to continue. And what they're going to try to do is to make sure that there's some balance kept between protecting the allies in the region and not triggering a crisis. But I don't see that they're going to take steps other than just what I just said to specifically assuage China, because if they do that, there's going to be a lot of response in the United States, and I don't think that's what President Obama wants.
Well, just in closing, though, it does seem that the whole idea of a pivot, or whatever the new term is, towards Asia, away from being embroiled in the Middle East and in the old Cold War lines, that's all sort of gone up in smoke, to the extent to which now we're getting drawn back into confrontation with Russia, and the Middle East has not gone away. So I guess, you know, that's what is that, the sorrows of being a superpower?
Well, that's definitely a true and valid critique. There are a lot of countries in Asia that are saying, oh, this U.S. partners in Asia, the pivot is not what it was promised to be because of continued U.S. interest in the Middle East and Eastern Europe, Central Europe, whatever you want to call it. I think that maybe it was, again, the pivot was supposed to be not just military. So I think inevitably Asia is becoming even more the economic center of the world. So whatever happens in the Middle East, Russia, that's going to continue. But I think that the administration perhaps overestimated how quickly it could shift and underestimated some of these other problems.
Well,
I still think the general idea, just the basic idea, which is that in the long run, Asia is going to be the center of most important things happening in the world, is probably accurate, but it doesn't mean it's going to happen as quickly as they thought.
Well, Joshua Kotlancic, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Joshua Kotlancic, who is a fellow for Southeast Asia at the Council on Foreign Relations and was a columnist for Time, a special correspondent for The New Republic, a senior correspondent for The American Prospect, and a contributing writer for Mother Jones. His books include Charm Offensive, How China's Soft Power is Transforming the World, and Democracy in Retreat, The Revolt of the Middle Class and the Worldwide Decline of Representative Government. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about a way around the telecom and cable monopolies who are about to eviscerate net neutrality. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Christopher Mitchell, the director of Telecommunications as Commons Initiative at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. He's a leading national expert on community broadband networks, and he runs muninetworks.org, the comprehensive online clearinghouse for information about community broadband. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christopher Mitchell.
Thank you for having me.
And Christopher, you're mentioned in an op-ed in Monday's New York Times by Susan Crawford, who was a lot of people thought that she might become the chairman of the FCC. She was often referred to as the Elizabeth Warren of the telecommunications world, but instead President Obama appointed a former lobbyist for the cable companies, Tom Wheeler, and he has really gotten people alarmed about indications that net neutrality is basically going to be destroyed. And even though he said the press reports in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal got it dead wrong. Nobody seems to be assured in any way that indeed Wheeler and the FCC are going to proceed to basically hand over the internet to these huge monopolies. Is that your understanding?
Well, I think there's a lot of rhetoric because this is an incredibly important issue. I don't think that we're about to see network neutrality destroyed, but I do fear that we're going to see the beginning of an erosive process that will end up with much less network neutrality, which is to say more toll booths where Comcast and the big cable companies can try and force us to pay more to do a lot of the same things we've been doing.
So, but the point, of course, of the reason I'm talking to you, Christopher Mitchell, is that Susan Crawford is saying there's an easy end run around this, and that is, you know, let these dinosaurs have their way. They own government, et cetera. And, you know, she wrote, I think, an extremely important book, which was called Captive Audience, The Telecom Industry and the Monopoly Power in the New Gilded Age. So taking that premise that we live in a new Gilded Age and this is a new monopoly, that there's a way around the destruction of net neutrality through municipal broadband. So let's talk about that, because that's your specialty and that's our hope, frankly.
Absolutely. The nice thing about municipal broadband or community networks more generally is that it's something local governments can do even if Washington falls down on the job. I would never suggest that they're either-or options. Frankly, we should be pursuing both, where we should have good regulations at the federal level that apply to the networks that everyone uses. And at the local level, communities should be free to build networks if they want to that offer a higher level of service, not just faster speeds, but also often lower prices, better customer service, and some of the other benefits like keeping money in the community. So rather than writing a check to Comcast, you're writing it out to a local entity that's more likely to keep that money in the community and put more money in your neighbor's pockets ultimately.
But wasn't that the intention of the 1996 Telecommunications Act, that municipalities could build a broadband and the act prohibits states from putting up unreasonable obstacles, which of course has exactly what the big telecom monopolies have done. Verizon and Comcast have been suing municipalities and states to preemptively block any chance at building municipal broadband networks.
That's right. The big cable and the telephone companies, they've really worked hard to make sure that communities didn't have this choice. 19 states now block municipal networks, and California actually is sort of in a middle ground. It's the 20th one sometimes cited because public service districts are not permitted to build networks in rural areas, except for under these stringent conditions. But to answer your question, yes. The 1996 Telecom Act, as framed by the people who wrote it and passed it, did intend to make sure that municipalities could build these networks. However, when it was interpreted later by the courts, and particularly in 2004 by the Supreme Court, in a case in Nixon v. Missouri, what happened was that the big cable companies won again, and they decided, the Supreme Court decided, that it was not clear enough that the federal government intended to take away states' rights to limit local government rights, which is a really complicated legal doctrine, but ultimately it ends up with a situation where cable companies can lobby state legislatures, throw all kinds of money at them and lies and misinformation, and walk away with legislation that all but prohibits, and in some cases even does prohibit, municipal networks from being built.
But isn't it also true, though, from that Supreme Court decision that the FCC could, if it wanted to, block those laws at the federal level?
Well, this is where it gets even more complicated, in that in the most recent decision, the Circuit Court of Washington, D.C., it ruled that the FCC has this power, which you may hear called the Section 706 power from the Telecommunications Act. And basically, if the FCC finds that advanced broadband services are being deployed in too slow of a time period, it has new powers it can use. One of those powers is the ability to get rid of barriers to investment. And the court very clearly told the FCC just 2 months ago that these powers included the ability to remove state restrictions on municipal networks. That was something that previously the FCC, which tends to be a fairly conservative organization in terms of how it interprets its own powers, it previously was not sure its powers reached that far. And so this was a clear sign to them that their powers did reach that far. And it was coming from a fairly conservative set of judges. So they have a pretty good sense that they have this power and that it will be upheld when it's inevitably challenged by those same big telecommunications companies. And so what we've seen recently is that the FCC and Chairman Wheeler in particular have spoken about examining this power and trying to figure out the best ways of removing some of these barriers to municipal networks.
And again, I'm speaking with Christopher Mitchell, who's the Director of Telecommunications as Commons Initiative at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. He's a leading national expert on community broadband networks, and he runs muninetworks.org, the comprehensive online clearinghouse for information about community broadband. So the good news here, and we're talking about an alternative to the end of net neutrality, which we may be declaring it dead prematurely, but it's certainly got a lot of people alarmed based upon leaks in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal that the new head of the FCC have said the reports are dead wrong, but everybody seems to think that they may unfortunately be right. But the good news here is that your organization apparently have counted 400 towns and cities across America that have installed or are planning to install high-speed broadband networks? That's extraordinary.
Yes, absolutely. It's actually over 400 that have already done it. It's about 150 where the network already reaches citywide. Some of those were already cable networks that were built maybe more than 10, 15 years ago. And then there's about 75, 80 where they're all fiber networks. And these are much more recent next-generation networks. So that's about 150 of these networks go citywide, and then there's over 250 where there's some level of service available in parts of the community. And so one of those examples actually, or a couple of them in California, involve Burbank, Santa Monica, Long Beach, I believe. These are networks that are available to people in certain areas of town, often businesses, and are available to be extended if the people within those communities would like to. They're networks that are owned by, in many cases, a municipal utility, or in the case of Santa Monica, the city itself. And so they are available to be expanded, but in many cases are pretty limited because I think local leaders aren't always sure that the citizens want to see the network expanded to serve everyone.
Well, but in the case of Santa Monica, it's called CityNet, and it's largely available to businesses. And it's a huge magnet to attracting business to Santa Monica, because we are deprived of the very thing that was invented here in the United States, high-speed broadband and fiber optics. As you point out, they've been laid all over the place. But the last mile's controlled, the pipes into people's homes are controlled by these monopolies who don't seem to care. They just want to extract as much money they can out of customers for as little service that they are required to provide. And you have this extraordinary alternative. So it's like a light bulb goes off. The minute you get high-speed broadband, you wonder what planet you've been on. I mean, the Japanese, the South Koreans, it's ubiquitous there. So it's little wonder that when people have access to it, it's incredibly increases productivity and business profits, etc. That's why it's a magnet. I don't understand why there'd be any ambivalence about wanting high-speed broadband, you know, whether you're on the left or the right.
Well, it's not a partisan issue on the local level, where people of all stripes agree that communities should be the ones to make the decision. And in fact, many of the communities, more than half of the communities that have built these networks, vote Republican. And so we don't see any sort of bias. But at the state and the federal level, it's often Republicans who are leading the charge with big money from the big cable and telephone companies to limit local authority to choose. One of the reasons, though, that people choose not to in some communities is because it's a very difficult business to be in. right now, Comcast is charging people a whole heck of a lot for money. If the city builds a network, then Comcast will suddenly cut its prices down much lower. And a lot of people have short memories, and they'll forget that they wanted the city to build a network. And then they will decide to pick Comcast, and they'll continue taking service from Comcast at lower prices. And that means that the new network, whether it's owned by the city in this case or even a private company, may not have enough subscribers to make its business model work. And at that point, it may go bankrupt, or the city may decide to sell it or have to subsidize it with funds from taxes or some other form. Now, that's quite rare that that's happened, but that's the threat. And that's the reality, which is that people really want a better option. But as soon as Comcast starts lowering prices, people forget. They stay with Comcast. Comcast runs any competition out of the market, and then it raises its prices back up again. And so to some extent, we need to make sure that we're supporting local businesses, and that if we encourage our communities to build these networks, that we stick with it, even if Comcast temporarily lowers its prices.
But apparently in the city of Chattanooga, where they have high-speed broadband, fiber optics are laid, and this is a city municipality, no matter what competition thrown at them, they can jack up the speed to, you know, amazing amounts of band width. Verizon put down Fios, but they Wall Street pushed out the CEO because he was spending too much money and they weren't having quick returns. And, of course, that's turned out to be an incredibly valuable profit center for Verizon. But what I understand that the city of Chattanooga, Tennessee, have is even better than any other commercial competitor is offering.
That perfectly illustrates the difference between community networks and the private sector networks. It's not just about the technology. The fiber makes a big difference, but the fact that Chattanooga is a city utility, and a particularly very well-run city utility at that, they have made a choice to offer the fastest speeds available in the country, to keep rates affordable, and to offer great customer service. Verizon built a fiber network that's quite similar technically in terms of the fiber and the technologies that are being used, but they offer higher prices, their customer service isn't nearly as good. And so there we see one of the main differences between these networks. But you're right, Chattanooga launched, I want to say, 4.5 years ago. I've been able to visit them twice, and I wrote a big case study about them called Broadband at the Speed of Light. They started by offering 15 megabit symmetrical connections, which means you get the same speeds upload as download, which is different from a cable system where often you get much slower uploads than downloads. So they started off with symmetrical 15 megabits. They went to 30, doubling it. Next year, they went up to 50 megabits. And then just last year, they went to 100. They've increased the speeds 4 times, once each year, without ever raising the prices. Now, I can't remember the last time I went more than 12 months without Comcast raising my prices. So you really do get a sense of the possibility of these. But Chattanooga just has this incredibly well-run municipal utility that has a real community spirit. You don't always see that. And in fact, you see Los Angeles in many ways not even really considering using its municipal utility in a similar fashion, which I think is too bad.
But the kind of service that you get in Chattanooga from the municipality, from this high-speed broadband, which, as you just pointed out, is extraordinary speed, isn't that exactly what the Netflixes and the Amazons and these other companies want? And what's going on now with the FCC in terms of allowing, apparently they're about to allow the Comcasts of this world to basically, force Netflix into a kind of payola scheme where you got to pay more and we'll speed up your service. But here's the alternative in Chattanooga, and it's available, and you say that 400 municipalities are working on, the same municipal broadband. This is, I think, this is really where the rubber meets the road, isn't it? The choice is between a kind of corporate monopoly extorting payola out of content deliverers and a municipality that's just open for all, and it's got a better, higher speed than anybody else.
That's right. I can't tell you the number of times I've spoken with small businesses around the United States that are served by municipal networks, and they talk about how previously there was some giant faceless corporation, and they would have to wait days and sometimes even weeks in rural areas for repairs to be made, whereas the municipal network serves people and gets them fixed up right away if something goes wrong. It's a totally different mindset. And, I don't want to say that municipal networks are the alternative to doing the right thing at the federal level, because it's important that at the federal level we maintain the freedom at the local level to make these choices. If we say that municipal networks are the solution we should focus on, and we should ignore stopping the Comcast-Time Warner Cable merger, for instance, that ignores the fact that if Comcast is allowed to become so much larger and more powerful, it will be harder for local governments to build networks. And similarly, even though Comcast violating network neutrality makes it more clear how much better municipal networks are because they don't have that same incentive to just maximize all the profits, the reality is that most people should have a network that is not screwing them that significantly. And so we need to maintain a look at both the federal level and making sure that we have good common sense regulations. But the local level is where we can really act, and we can make sure that even if we don't succeed at the federal level, we have networks that are going to meet our needs. You had asked about the big companies like Netflix and Amazon and the others. And Netflix, to its credit, has been really good on public policy, trying to encourage good policies that will benefit everyone. But I think when you look at Amazon and some of these other companies, they're going to be able to pay the toll. And so they may not like paying tolls to Comcast, but they know that they're going to always be in a better position than any startup rivals. And so in some ways, tolls could help some of these more established business and really hurt innovation. And that's a real threat, I think, to all of us.
Well, Christopher Mitchell, I thank you very much for joining us. And I think your admonition that not exactly what you said, but what you're implying here is that people should hold the FCC's feet to the fire, and particularly Chairman Tom Wheeler's, and not to sell us out on net neutrality. So these aren't mutually exclusive, are they?
That's right. We need to do both.
Well, I thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I'm speaking with Christopher Mitchell, who is the director of Telecommunications as Commons Initiative at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. He's a leading national expert on community broadband networks, and he runs muninetworks.org, the comprehensive online clearinghouse of information about community broadband. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared.